This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You've reached the edge of the world.
Today on Dreamland, we have a really remarkable individual who has made some discoveries that are not like what you would expect. They're not about the present. They're about the past, which is in many ways more interesting nowadays than the present, because in the present we're kind of stuck in this endless loop of waiting for disclosure, and the latest thing that's come out is a new film with 47 or so officials, people who are all saying yes, it's real, etc., and so forth, and that's fine. But we've kind of had enough of that, haven't we? Everyone saying it's real is fine. People from the inside, great. Telling their experiences, fascinating. But until the scientific community has materials and biological specimens to study outside of the secret government, this is not going anywhere. Not any farther than it has. And probably the defense establishment knows that, which is why they're doing it. So we're kind of going beyond that with Dreamland right now. I want to go into areas that actually matter. And this is an area that actually matters. Because Gregory Shushan, who we're talking to today, has done an incredible study of the near-death experience as it was perceived in ancient times, from the Sumerians to the Maya to the Egyptians, and it is cool. It's fascinating. So I'm going to welcome Greg to the show right now, and welcome Greg to Dreamland. Greg's website, by the way, is gregoryshushan.com. He has a YouTube channel, and he's got he's got all of the incredible academic cojones that we need to believe him. I don't want to bore you with all of that stuff, but suffice to say, he's a former researcher at Oxford and University of Wales. He is affiliated with Birmingham, Newman University, University of Winchester, Marion University, and the Parapsychological Foundation. But the bottom line is this, all of that aside, he's absolutely brilliant, and he's got this. Greg, welcome to the show. I'm so glad to have you on at last. We had problems last week. We were going to do the show, but the internet intervened. They're rebuilding a lot of the infrastructure around here after the fires that we had here in LA, and it was down. So now he's here.
Yeah. Well, thanks for having me on, Whitley. It's a real privilege to be here, and thanks for that buildup. I hope I can live up to it.
Okay. Now, there's a leap here. The book has got a fundamental leap in it, from NDEs to ancient descriptions of the afterlife and afterlife beliefs. How did you make that leap?
I started out actually in archaeology before I defected to the history of religious studies kind of area. And as I was doing my Egyptian archaeology research, part of that involves reading the ancient Egyptian hieroglyphs, learning Middle Egyptian and the different kinds of scripts and language. And so I was reading the pyramid texts and Book of the Dead and coffin texts. And these texts are basically guidebooks to the afterlife. They tell the spirit or the soul what to expect, how to negotiate the transition from this world to the next, and all of the phases that they will encounter on the way. And as I was reading this, I thought, if you strip back the kind of cultural elaborations and symbolism, what we're left with is something that was really familiar from near-death experiences. So the soul leaves the body, and the mummy in this case in Egypt, travels through darkness, enters a realm of light, an other world, encounters a being of light in the form of the sun god Re, meets deceased relatives, has an evaluation of their earthly life, reaches borders and barriers, and all of these, you know, obviously very familiar near-death experience type elements, but expressed to me, I thought, in a culturally Egyptian sort of way.
How did you, I want to talk a little bit about methodology, because you're comparing the modern NDE concept with ancient texts, and you have to kind of build that, because they, and yet there's a lot of, and the book is rich with evidence that that's exactly what they were experiencing. What was the methodology? How did you do this?
That's a great question, because, yeah, I mean, anybody could say, oh, those are similarities. That must mean they base their beliefs on NDEs. But I wanted to test that question in a more rigorous way. And I thought, given the lack of narrative descriptions of near-death experiences from ancient Egypt, or any kind of statement saying where they got their afterlife beliefs, I thought maybe the best way to test this idea is to do a cross-cultural comparison. So I looked at afterlife beliefs in the civilizations you mentioned. So it was pre-Buddhist China, the Vedic India, kind of before what we recognize as Hinduism today, the kind of foundational religion of Hinduism, Egypt, ancient Sumer, and old Babylonian period of Mesopotamia, and then Aztec and Mayan. And I chose those because they essentially emerged independently of each other, culturally speaking. There was some trade between, say, Egypt and Sumer, and between Sumer and India and India and China, but to kind of suggest that there was a diffusion of this afterlife story that just happens to be so similar to NDEs, that traveled to all these civilizations is basically, there's no evidence for that. And I think it's far-fetched. So I wanted to kind of minimize that possibility that there is one grand human narrative that they're all expressing that has a common origin. And so I thought the only way to then explain the similarities cross-culturally is either some kind of psychological thing, something about the human brain, which then that doesn't really make sense, because why is the human brain telling this same story with these same patterns? It doesn't have like an evolutionary basis or benefit. So when everything sifted out, I kind of thought, okay, this really is looking like they're basing their experiences on near-death experiences, their afterlife beliefs.
So basically what's happening is that, now you mentioned the human brain, and is this something to do with the brain in the sense that because of certain structures in the brain, like the people who criticize the validity of the NDE say it's basically a kind of end game on the part of the brain. The brain is setting itself up to die, and it creates what amounts to an illusion of immortality. Mm-hmm. How do you respond to that?
I respond in the way that, well, first of all, I just want to make it clear that I'm not necessarily arguing that my work shows that near-death experiences really are evidence for an afterlife. It can sort of be used in either argument. You know, people who are proponents of the dying brain theory could say, well, they're similar cross-culturally because we all have brains that die, and this is what happens when the brain dies. I don't think that's the case for a number of reasons, but we can get to that in a second. But as far as that question goes, just the fact that, you know, these experiences are happening. The first documentary experience that I've been able to find, which I consider a documentary experience, is ancient Sumer, so about 1800 BCE, and that has similarities with NDEs in the present. To me, that shows that it can't just be, let me just backtrack. So the sequence of events and the fact that there are these nine consistent elements, to me, shows that it can't just be a psychological thing, because the onus is kind of on the critic to say, well, why don't people conceive of an afterlife where you're lying in the tomb and your consciousness sinks down through the underworld into an undersea realm? Why is that, you know, less of an option than rising outside the body, ascending to another world, meeting a being of light? I mean, all these elements that just happen to be typical of an NDE, I think it's too consistent to be a coincidence, really.
Yeah, you know, the west wall of the entrance to the Pyramid of Unas, where the pyramid text is located, is a detailed set of instructions for the pharaoh that involves him basically leaving his body and going to a riot.
Yeah, exactly. And the architecture of the pyramid and the way the texts are placed on the inside of the on the walls is basically a way of the entombment, the action of the entombment and the instructions on how to put the mummy into the tomb mirrors the soul's experience in the other world. So it's that as above, so below thing, which was so important to Egyptian psyche and cosmology, that, you know, everything has to be preserved and mirrored on Earth in order for it to be facilitated in the other world.
We're going to take a little break and we'll be right back.
The Fourth Mind, Whitley Strieber's explosive new book. The first time alien anatomy, alien genetics, the alien brain, and the alien mind have ever been detailed publicly. Learn how they think. Learn what they believe. Learn what we mean to them. Learn when they are coming and why. Then, in part two, learn why we don't have powers like telepathy, levitation, and healing that they do have. Find out about the catastrophe that took our powers from us. Find out how we can regain them. The Fourth Mind. Totally new. Incredibly important. Get your copy today on Amazon. Available as a Kindle, hardcover, softcover, and an audiobook read by Whitley Strieber.
We're talking to Dr. Greg Shushan, Near-Death Experience in Ancient Civilizations, The Origin of the World's Afterlife Beliefs. And I'm sort of gobsmacked by this whole concept that we've known this for so long and we've been doing this for so long, but I can't quit circling around the idea that it's basically a way the brain handles its death. Mm-hmm. And yet at the same time, in my life, I have had so much experience with the dead. Incredible experience, which any of my listeners probably know all about, because I've talked about it for years. So I believe that there is an afterlife, frankly. Mm. And was there anything that you saw in any of the literature that you kind of reinterpreted, I guess would be the way to put it, that would suggest that they knew more, they were more certain about that than we are?
Interesting. I mean, all of these texts are presented not as speculation or some kind of metaphysical ideal. They're presented as if they are actually, as if it's knowledge about the afterlife, as if they know. And that also kind of reinforces the NDE concept. It's almost as if we're expected to believe these texts based on the fact that somebody had been there and returned, because how else would somebody be able to write about the journey to the other world unless somebody had actually had it. So I think it was seen as knowledge. There wasn't a lot of debate going on in the civilizations that I looked at. And I should also add that aside from Egypt, I didn't expect to find this. I thought I was just going to be looking at the afterlife beliefs in the religious texts. But aside from Egypt, I found near-death experiences in documentary contexts in all of the other civilizations. Including sometimes in sort of medical, magical text, as in India, where they describe how the soul can be sent to the other world to rescue somebody who's in danger of dying. So basically, how to bring back somebody who's having an NDE in the middle of their experience. And then there are just accounts like from ancient China, where it's in a very, lodged with the government bureau of documents and very detailed and documented and, dated and signed. So they were obviously very much taken seriously as genuine phenomena.
Well, you know, both of those statements imply many, many questions. Let's start with India. Can you elaborate a little bit on what you found there that you were talking about? Because I want to know the way they experience this. I think that people left and they could go rescue souls and bring them back. Is that what you're... Okay, can you talk a little bit about that? That's absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, there's not a lot in the text about it, but it's and to me that it's almost casually stated. It's like, here's just another medical process you can do, the same if you have a broken arm or a wound or whatever. If somebody's dying and you know them, then it tells you essentially how to, or at least that it's possible to travel to the other world, send your soul there and bring them back. And that's something that actually recurs cross-culturally in shamanic context. This is a very much a, they call it soul retrieval in anthropology. So it's this idea is found in Native American societies, Polynesian societies, and other places around the world. Before that, in the earliest Vedic text, the Rig Veda, there might be some kind of shamanic element there too, because they talk about these individuals they called munis, M-U-N-I, who are kind of like shaking, raving people having these ecstatic experiences. And they sound very much like shamans. And that's in the context of, again, talking about the soul and its journey to the other world and how to get there. And also the consumption of this substance or beverage called soma, which is believed to be some kind of hallucinogenic drink that that was used in a shamanic context for accessing the other world.
Yeah, great. Graham Hancock has written a book called Supernatural about that has a lot to do with these drinks and so forth. And there's been recently found at Ephesus a cup that had on the inside of the cup, there were the remains of plant forms that would have been hallucinogenic in nature if ingested. And since they were in a cup, it's pretty hard not to assume they were ingested.
Yeah. Yeah. And in fact, from Cyprus, there were quite a lot of opium shaped vessels, and they found residue of opium at the bottom of these vessels. So
does opium cause hallucinations?
I guess not hallucinating, but it causes an altered state of consciousness, which I guess if you were undertaking a ritual with the intention of traveling to the other world, and then you would take opium and have this, you know, opium dream kind of, you know, Thomas De Quincey kind of thing.
I'll bet you could have a directed opium dream if somebody knew what they were doing and how to direct it.
I think so, yeah.
Probably, yeah. Yeah, that would be the explanation. That's really interesting. You know, you look across the ancient world and you think to yourself, we broke off from that somehow, especially in the West.
Yeah.
Christianity is like a break with the whole relationship between the planet and the person. Mm. And suddenly we're looking up at the sky and we're kind of alone. When we were, you know, when we were more part of the earth, there were gods everywhere. We saw deity in everything. Mm. Even in the West, we did.
Yeah.
We lost that. And maybe also when we lost that, we lost sight of this journey. Mm. And let's go through some of the different civilizations. Let's go, like, it's the Sumerian civilization, the material you've got in the book, incredibly rich. Mm. Tell us a little bit about them and their, who they were, first of all. I mean, let's not assume my listeners know who they were.
Right.
and what they achieved. I mean, this is, folks, these people kind of come out of nowhere. But, Greg, you tell us the story.
Yeah, so this is a civilization in sort of, well, the earliest text that I was looking at was around 1800 BCE, so, you know, around getting close to 4,000 years ago. And it's a civilization that emerged in modern-day Iraq between the Tigris and Euphrates River. They had, you know, monumental architecture, writing, literature, complex society, and a very rich religious tradition, astronomical traditions. They had various kinds of beliefs about the afterlife. So on the one hand, the evidence I found was myths about descents to the underworld in the form of the most famous one is probably the descent of Inanna, which in later Mesopotamian culture in Akkadian Babylonian, she's called Ishtar. But essentially the myth is she travels to the underworld in order to overthrow the queen of the underworld, Erish Kigala. And as she's traveling there, she has to kind of shed each one of her earthly features or attributes. And to me, that's kind of like, you know, a shamanic thing as well. She's she has to become this transformed kind of person to undertake this journey. But it has it's very much a story, so it's very different from NDEs in a lot of ways, and it's not presented as if it's happening to an actual individual. She's a goddess, and it very much has a storytelling mythical sort of quality. But then on the other hand, we have a text which I think is probably the earliest historical NDE. Everyone's probably heard, or a lot of people have heard of the Epic of Gilgamesh, which is the kind of key Mesopotamian mythological text, and has a lot of features that are similar to later biblical texts. So like the flood myth, for example, comes from ancient Sumer. So this particular example, Gilgamesh, in his Sumerian context, he was originally a Sumerian king, was called Bilgamez. And there's a passage that was kind of left out of the actual epic of Gilgamesh, and it talks about his near-death experience. It tells of how he's lying on his deathbed, his soul goes to the other world, he meets a being of light in the form of the Sumerian sun god, whose name is Utu, and it says that the sun god undoes his heart, which in the process of kind of evaluating his earthly life, and then once his earthly life is reviewed by this panel of judges who are also radiating light, he then becomes a judge in the underworld, or at least he will do when he comes back and dies for good. He meets deceased relatives, and there's a joyful celebration held in his honor. And then finally, he's sent back to his body, and he wakes up in order to prepare his tomb and get ready for when he really actually does die. So it's got, you know, the transformational effect of the experience, and all these other kind of layers of NDEs. And again, importantly, from my perspective, presented as if it's a true story rather than a myth.
NDEs, and by the way, folks, you might have seen some little electronic issues. I'm having electronic issues today, but there's nothing new about that around this house. It's called the unquiet flat for a reason. In any case, we went through a long period in the West, especially, where this was kind of discouraged. Mm-hmm. Once Christianity took over, suddenly there was only one possible movement of the soul after death. It would leave the body and either go to heaven or go to hell. Mm-hmm. Judging from the strictness of the medieval church, it does usually go to hell. In any case, but then modern times come along, and something very unexpected happens. Science becomes the engine of the NDE, because medicine learns to bring people back from the dead. Mm-hmm. That happened to my wife. Wow. She had an incredible NDE because of medicine. Mm-hmm. The doctors in the ER and in the intensive care unit are the modern shaman. Mm-hmm. Because they don't induce an NDE, but they rescue you from death, and yeah, you come back with that memory. Mm-hmm. In the past, all of these civilizations, I think, intentionally attempted to create NDEs in various ways. I know that some of the shamanic practices among Native Americans were darn dangerous. Hmm. Because you had to tempt death.
Yeah.
Was that, how does that work into what happened like in the more evolved civilizations, more urbanized civilizations like Egypt and Sumeria?
We don't really have enough evidence to be able to say. There really is, like from Egypt, you know, there's kind of an assumption that there was some kind of shamanic activities and mind-altering practices, but we don't really have solid evidence. From Sumer, I mentioned, similar to India, actually, there are these kind of shamanic type figures that are described as long-haired ascetics who have some kind of shamanic function, but there's really just not enough text to be able to say. I think from China, we also have poetry that's inspired by the visions of shamans, and it's also about traveling to the other world. They're much more colorful and elaborate, so it's things like riding dragons into the sky and then into an undersea realm of shells and beauty. And then in the Upanishads in India, it's these very kind of metaphysical, transcendent experience, riding into the stars on a wild swan and things like that. So I think it's a lot of it is symbolic language for an experience that is difficult to describe, that's ineffable, a transcendent, you know, universal cosmic sort of experience.
It also sounds incredibly beautiful.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, they really felt the beauty of it very strongly.
Mm-hmm. But you were saying earlier about the Native American practices, and that's true that in some cases, in fact, there's a sub-Saharan African account, I think it's the Fang people, where they actually described the shamanic process of traveling to the other world as being clubbed to death. So obviously their definition of death is different than ours, but what they meant was basically being clubbed into an insensible state with the intention of traveling to the other world. And some would even say they would be burned to death. So we have to kind of take some of this with a grain of salt, but the notion is that they're bringing about such physical trials, they're compromising their physical body to such an extent that they probably really are having something like an NDE, because their body is you know, probably genuinely near death.
Yeah, there was a movie called A Man Called Horse.
Oh, right.
Which I couldn't watch. It was too terrifying.
Yeah.
But it was basically about a shamanic experience and apparently based on real research into the traditions of the particular tribe involved. Mm-hmm. And it used extreme pain to cause the person to separate from their body. Mm-hmm. And the Sundance of the Sioux is one that involves extreme pain. Mm-hmm. But I'm not familiar. I know a few people in the Sioux tradition, and no one's ever said anything to me about it inducing an OBE, but I can certainly see how it would to dance for 7 days with pierced nipples and day and night. I mean, until you basically collapse.
Yeah.
That might cause an NDE.
Yeah. Well, and there's also overt examples of these kind of religious movements being based on NDEs of their founders. So like the ghost dance, for example, is one of the most famous, but most people don't know that it was based on the NDEs of the prophets who originally had them. And then they came back to life and said, you know, they wanted to sort of democratize the afterlife for people and make it accessible to them in a way where they didn't have to die. So they would institute these dances where they would, you know, dance and chant and drum repetitively for days possibly also take drugs, until they collapsed with the intention of traveling to the other world. And you can see images of them, you know, a field of people doing this all together. And it all goes back to the NDEs of the founders. And some of these are still in practice. The Indian Shaker Church, for example, was also rooted in an NDE.
The journey to the other world can happen to people who have an out-of-body experience, if it's someone other than me. My out-of-body experiences have all been very definitely in this world. And I knew Bob Monroe a little bit, not much. Mm-hmm. I mean, we just met one time. Mm-hmm. And I asked him about that, and he said that he'd had most of his experiences were in this world. In other words, you go out of your body and you're still here. Mm-hmm. There's no sign of any journey at all. I mean, there's no place, doesn't seem like there's any place else at all.
Right.
And it gets me to sort of circle back to something we touched on a few minutes ago, which is, I'm going to reframe it as when rescuing souls and giving souls help to reach the afterlife by the souls of the living. Is that there's a certain amount of that in the ancient literature, I believe, isn't there?
There is. Yeah.
Well, can you tell us a little bit about it? Because this rescuing souls really interests me. Yeah. I mean, I'm an old guy, and I'm going to probably definitely need rescue if my afterlife experience is anything like my OBE experience.
Yeah. Yeah, again, I mean, because these texts are so ancient and what we have from each of these civilizations is fairly limited. It's extensive, but it's also limited to a certain type of text through the accident of survival or what was deemed important or what wasn't destroyed later on. So really the main example I can think of is the one from India that I mentioned in that kind of magical medical text, the Atharva Veda. I mean, we know that it happened also in Mesoamerica in Aztec and Mayan rituals. But there, and I think probably still are in Mexico and Guatemala and Belize, places where the Mayas are still exist. But in these particular texts, you know, they were preserved by missionaries and early explorers in some cases, sometimes early anthropologists. But for the most part, missionaries who they would not really go into much detail. The reason for recording their afterlife beliefs was essentially two things. One was justification for converting them to show how satanic they were and how savage they were and all these other things. And the other thing was to understand what their religious beliefs, to know better how to appeal to them, to make Catholicism more appealing than their own indigenous beliefs. So everything is kind of in service of a particular agenda. So what survives from Mesoamerica is often kind of filtered through the Catholic lens and what they wanted us to what they wanted to keep, essentially.
We're going to take another brief break, folks. We'll be right back.
Have you ever read Communion? Or have you never read Communion? It's out in a new edition. Very powerful, a subtly new cover that reflects the fact that the visitors are now looking back at us because they truly are. You can get it from the unknowncountry.com store as a Kindle, as a beautiful, sumptuous paperback, or as an unabridged audiobook read by me. It's the first time in the whole life of Communion that it has been read in full in audio format. And believe you me, I felt that reading. I put my life, my memories, into it, and I trust you can hear it in the voice. I sure felt it while I was reading. So get Communion, listen to it, read it. Communion is of central importance to all of our lives.
We're talking to Dr. Gregory Shushan. Greg's new book is Near-Death Experience in Ancient Civilizations, The Origin of the World's Afterlife Beliefs. In a sense, Greg, there's someone calling us, saying, don't forget. Don't forget where you are and who you are. And what does this tell you about life itself? In other words, as you go through this, all of this evidence and all of the wisdom of the past, because they were comfortable with this. We're not so much anymore in the West, especially, but they were. And we became uncomfortable with it with the rise of Christianity, and we began to narrow the definition of what the afterlife was until finally in the Enlightenment, we decided there wasn't one. Mm-hmm. This is it.
Yeah.
And most people in the West still believe that. If you go to Europe, you find hardly anybody who believes in an afterlife at all. Mm-hmm. And books on this subject, as you may or may not know, not on this subject, particularly your subject, but books on afterlife don't sell in like France and Germany at all. They sell somewhat well in England, but not like they do in the U.S. The U.S. is much more committed to this idea. Mm-hmm. And in India, they sell very well, too, of course, because the Indians have this as part of their cultural narrative still.
Right.
We lost something. And I don't think you really went into, I don't remember seeing this in the book, but I wonder if you have some thoughts about what we lost and why and how. Because we go from this rich kind of animistic religion that's filled with earth magic and soul magic to another religion that is no earth magic in it, mm-hmm. and the only soul magic is your moral state when you die.
Yeah, I do. And on top of that, we also went from... So another thing in common with all of these ancient civilizations is the idea, and in common with near-death experience, by the way, is the idea of transcendence in the afterlife. And that's often expressed in the form of becoming one with the divine. So in Egypt, you don't just meet the sun god, you also are the sun god. At the same time, you're separate from the sun god. So it's this kind of divine integration, but also retaining your own capacity for thought. But in any case, it's a direct unifying experience with the divine. Then when Christianity comes along, that's the antithesis of Christianity. You don't become one with the divine. You become, you know, you may sit next to God or next to Jesus or whatever. And to me, I have a kind of pet theory about this. So, you know, Christianity is predicated on the death and rebirth of Jesus, but his experience during that time, what would have been his near-death experience, is secondary. We hear almost nothing about it. There's a brief passage in the New Testament where it says he descended to hell to free the souls of sinners. So the only fuller expression of that I know of that's in any detail is the Gospel of Nicodemus, which is an apocryphal biblical text, which at some point, I don't know if it was the Council of Nicaea in 395 or whatever, but at some point the church decided this is not church doctrine. This is not important to Christianity, Jesus's near-death experience. Whatever happened to him in between, all we need to know is that he freed the sinners because that reinforces his forgiveness and his kindness. So I speculate that near-death experience might have originally been a more central feature to Christianity, but near-death experiences, people who have them, they kind of indicate that everybody has direct access to the divine, and that we also are kind of sparks of the divine. We're kind of the same divine element. In Indian terms, you know, that Atman, the inner unchanging self, is one and the same as Brahman, the universal cosmic oneness. And because that's a threat to Christianity, you know, everybody who is a Christian, anybody has to go through Jesus and the church to be able to have a positive afterlife, whereas NDEs challenge that whole concept.
It was the politicization of the afterlife.
Yeah.
In the sense that the church set itself up as a gatekeeper. Mm-hmm. You had to go through, you didn't go through the church, you didn't have any afterlife. I mean, you, what was it called, limbo?
Oh, yeah.
But they closed limbo. When I was a little boy in Catholic school, the nuns would say that sisters who were so loved children so much, they gave up their place in heaven in order to serve the children in limbo. Of course, then they also hit you up the side of the head with an eraser without a second thought. Right. So I often wondered about that dichotomy. Yeah. Although I have to say that the nuns I went with, the Sisters of the Sacred Heart, were really lovely. They were from Canada, and they were selected by the order because they enjoyed little boys. And you know, the Catholic thing is so screwed up. I'm not talking about anything weird. Okay. I'm just talking about normal.
Yeah.
And so we had a lot of nuns that were wonderful. I have a wonderful memories of my childhood. And the other thing about my school was that they knew how to cook.
Right.
And they had our food was fabulous. We really, really good. Now when you go there as an alum, it's, you know, it's the mandated menu and forget it. Okay, well, I don't want to digress here. We're deep into this. Now let's talk about consistency of NDEs.
Okay.
Because there's a kind of consistency in the way the journey is is unfolds in these in various ancient texts mm-hmm. that you point out in the book. Could you elaborate on that? Because it's just like the modern NDE has a consistency. They right. did too. Can you elaborate a little bit on that?
Yeah, I mean, essentially, there were about nine elements that really just seemed to be superimposed from the NDE onto the afterlife beliefs of all of these civilizations. And usually in the same sequence. In Egypt, it's difficult to puzzle it out because we don't know exactly the intended sequence of the ritual texts that describe the afterlife. But, you know, in a way that makes sense to kind of make a narrative progression out of it, it does seem like, you know, the progression is leaving the body, often seeing the body from a perspective outside of it. So the out-of-body experience, traveling to the other world, meeting the deceased relatives, meeting a being of light. I think I forgot to mention darkness and light, those type of experiences. And then some kind of evaluation of the person's life. And then because these are texts about the afterlife and the journey to the afterlife and not about near-death experiences, there are borders and barriers, but in our cases, the souls pass them and we get to find out what happens to the souls as they progress into the other regions of the afterlife. Whereas in an NDE, after those barriers, they would be coming back to the body.
Let's go on now to moral judgment. One of the things that's so notable about the whole Egyptian vision is that when the person dies, they are judged against the weight of their soul is judged against the weight of a feather. Mm. And there are the, 42 laws of Ma'at that are involved. And if you live by these laws, you are as light as a feather or lighter than a feather. You have to be lighter than a feather.
Right.
What does that all mean?
Yeah, it's the feather of Ma'at, which you just, Ma'at is sort of the principle of rightness and order and justice of the universe. So you have to be the equivalent or better than that, and basically be able to prove that you lived a just and righteous sort of life. And if you did, then you can progress to a more positive afterlife realm. If not, then you're at risk of being in the later texts that I was looking at, mainly the pyramid texts and coffin texts, but in the Book of the Dead and later, there's this figure who's kind of half hippopotamus crocodile creature who will consume the souls. And in Egypt, rather than eternal punishment or damnation and hellfire, the real fear was annihilation, was complete non-existence. So it's not so much that you're going to be punished by these different kinds of threats and perils that you encounter in the other world. It's that you're going to just be annihilated. Which it's a pretty different approach. And actually, I should mention a really interesting parallel to what you're saying about Christianity and limbo is in Egypt, China, and India, at least, is a very clear progression of the development of afterlife conceptions over time. So in the earliest stages, the emphasis was really not on punishment and threats. It was overcoming obstacles in order to reach transcendence and divinity. But as time progressed and as people became more and more literate and had more access to information about the afterlife, that's when punishments started becoming more important and given in much more almost loving descriptions, detailed descriptions, especially in India and China, where the punishments would fit the crime. So they would say, you go to hell. And now it's depicted as hell rather than just the other world. And if you gossiped, you're going to have a hot iron rod shoved through your tongue. And if you raised your hand against your parents, you're going to have your arm lopped off. And it's all this, messages to the people about the kind of justice that's going to be meted out to you. And in a very Catholic way, threatening your afterlife through your present behavior. So I think, you know, there's this old theory that the afterlife beliefs arose because of kind of manipulation by the elite, that the elite were trying to control human behavior. So they came up with heaven and hell to ensure that. But I think they originated in NDEs and then gradually became exploited by the elite as they became more accessible to the populace.
You know, my wife, I wrote a book called The Afterlife Revolution. My wife was a, I don't know what she was. She was a master of some kind for sure. And she, before she died, in 9 months before she died, long before I knew she was going to die, she began to create an avatar.
Sorry.
The dog doesn't agree with me.
Carlos.
Well, folks, we're going to take a little break. We'll be right back.
This is a brief excerpt from an interview with two contactees who had an 11-day close encounter experience and are now willing to speak about it, really, for the first time. To hear their whole interview and many others, subscribe to unknowncountry.com. Here's the excerpt. Did you see the man's face?
Yes. Actually, that one is very clear to me. It was kind of longish, and he didn't look completely human, but because he had very, very thin hair, almost non-existent, but he was young, I believe that it was kind of blonde. And he was very tall, like at least six feet, and he was so thin that he looked kind of strange.
And what happened then?
Well, he wanted me to go with him, or to stay with him. He wanted me to stay with him on the ship. And I'd been married for 6 months, and I wasn't about to go running off to stay on the ship.
Now, surely you want more. You must want more. And there is more. Not only this contactee interview, but many others, many of them just as extraordinary, on unknowncountry.com, plus everything else that we offer, my audio books, the meditations, the talks on the key, William Henry's wonderful revelation show in its entire run, and Strieber's brilliant and magical mysterious powers, and so much more. Hours and hours of listening pleasure. Learn from the meditations on the site. Really learn, because they're real and they're valuable. Subscribe to unknowncountry.com right now. Go to unknowncountry.com. Click on the subscribe tab. We are running very low on new subscribers now, and that should not be. It should not be happening. So you do it. You go there and you do it today.
We're back with Greg Shushan. His book, The Near-Death Experience in Ancient Civilizations, The Origin of the World's Afterlife Beliefs. And as I was getting ready to say, my wife Anne, before she died, 9 months before she died, she began creating an avatar, which is a white moth. And it was, after she died, it became clear for a lot of reasons that most of my listeners and viewers already know, that this white moth was definitely a psychopomp of some kind. It was not a normal moth. Dozens of people in a group at one point saw it disappear before their eyes. And it was really remarkable. So, but she said to me something that circles all the way back to what the Egyptians believed. She said, after her death, I said, what happens to the ones that, the evil, basically, the ones that do evil? And she said, nothing. And I thought for a moment, that means there's no retribution, there's no balancing. But then I realized what she really meant was they just disappear. Huh. I think she's right. I think the Egyptians were right. And the rest of it is civilizations became more complex or under more pressure, like in the Roman civilization. the afterlife was politicized in order to keep control over people.
Yeah.
But the truth is much simpler. Mm-hmm. The truth is, if you don't work at it, you don't go anywhere. Mm. Just disappear back into the earth.
Yeah.
What do you respond to that in any way?
I mean, I know there are people who have distressing NDEs where they feel like they're in this terrifying dark space, and you know, they're being dragged downwards, or a threat at being dragged downwards, and they're often more kind of confusional than regular NDEs. So I don't know what, you know, the answer to those, what the nature of those actually are, any more than I know what other NDEs are. But they do
seem,
there's something about them that seems to be a different type of experience, aside from them just being distressing and negative. I'm not totally convinced that they're the same type of thing as an NDE, that there really are a, you know, if NDEs are really an access to an afterlife, I'm not sure those distressing ones also are. But there is also the idea that I do think our psychological state is going to impact the dying experience. And this is something that comes up a lot in Native American traditions and Tibetan traditions, that, you know, dying consciously and recognizing this, and in fact, it's implicit in any kind of guidebook to the afterlife. You have to be aware of what's going on. You have to die in a sort of lucid, cognizant, conscious sort of way in order to have a positive experience. And I don't think it's necessary that you consciously guide it as you might in an advanced lucid dream, but just being aware of the kinds of things that are going to happen and understanding them, I think would help us to negotiate them. But yeah, whether we fail at that, whether it would just be annihilation or a lower rebirth, a reincarnation or what, there's so many different traditions that say different things about what would happen. It's difficult to say, I think. And even, you know, there's evidence for the, you know, children who remember past lives and things like that. So there's so much about the subject, I think, that's still mysterious. And part of it is because of the diversity of traditions and the different types of evidence that's out there from parapsychology.
It's just fascinating. You know, I think to myself, we've been doing this for a long time. And you know, and for longer than there was civilization, because the shamanic traditions go gosh knows how far back.
Yeah.
Maybe all the way back to the beginning. When you look at the cave paintings, you know, they were probably trying to summon those animals. And with using what we would consider magical techniques. And science dismisses all of this as just nothing, because they can't study it. In other words, they can't detect anything of an afterlife. So therefore they believe it doesn't exist.
Right.
That was not true in the ancient world. The ancient world lived in a very different state. They were living in more than one world at the same time. I know Native Americans who are like that, who live in more than one world at the same time. And I'm sure that's true of indigenous peoples all over the planet.
Yeah.
It's certainly true in Indies.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. And it's interesting from, another book I wrote, Near Death Experience in Indigenous Religions, that's kind of relevant to a lot of what we're talking about too. And that's where I looked at Native American Pacific region and sub-Saharan African kind of small-scale societies, what used to be called tribal societies. And I found that in Australia, I was really perplexed to not find any accounts of near-death experiences, because everywhere else we have good evidence from anthropologists and missionaries and explorers of people actually saying, you know, they would ask, how do you know about the afterlife? And they would say, so-and-so went there, came back, and this is what he told us. So we had, you know, and from Native America, for example, I found 70 accounts or references to NDEs, and over half of them also had statements that this is where our knowledge about the afterlife came from. So from Australia, I'm, you know, searching and searching and searching, and I can't find any accounts of NDEs, but I am finding numerous accounts of shamanic journeys to the other world. And I eventually realized that it's not the context of the experience that mattered. It was the journey itself. And even I think what was happening was people were considered shamans by virtue of having had an NDE. And that whole aspect was just not relevant. So we have all these accounts of shamanic journeys to the afterlife, soul retrieval, and going there to seek knowledge, healing knowledge, clairvoyance, all kinds of stuff. But the death and after the death context and returning from death context is kind of missing, which I found pretty interesting.
Well, this has come that sad moment in the show when we say goodbye to our free Dreamlanders. And I urge you, as always, to subscribe to unknowncountry.com so you can listen to the whole show. And if barring that, subscribe to our YouTube channel. Greg's book, wonderful book, is available on, I'm sure, in bookstores and on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. You can also get it through the Unknown Country bookstore, and it is a really rich, rich journey. Near-death experience and ancient civilizations, the origin of the world's afterlife beliefs. And when we come back, we're going to be talking about reincarnation and the remarkable human journey that has grown up around the idea of reincarnation and how it relates to near-death experiences. Free Dreamlanders, thank you as always for being with us today.
You've been listening to Dreamland. Be sure to tune in again next week. Dreamland is brought to you by unknowncountry.com and its family of subscribers. Our theme music is The O of Pleasure by Ray Lynch. Unknown Country was founded by Ann Streber. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our coordinator is Amy Safrankova. Whitley Strieber is your Dreamland host, and I'm your announcer, Ted Alexander.